You're listening to the No BS Nutrition Podcast. I'm registered dietitian Hannah McGee.
And I'm neuroscience PhD student Tariq Youssef. And for the next hour, we're going to tackle popular nutrition topics from a scientific lens, promoting fact over fiction with no BS. Welcome back to the No BS Nutrition Podcast. This is Tariq Youssef, neuroscience PhD student.
And I am registered dietitian Hannah McGee, and I'm so excited to be back with you all on this lovely Friday. Happy Friday. It's almost the weekend.
Happy Friday. Yes, happy Friday. It's sprummer. I don't know. Sometime between spring and summer. and there's a thunderstorm warning today. Mm-hmm. There are forest fire smoke warnings all the time. Mm-hmm. Climate change is upon us, folks. And I'm just happy we get to all be together to experience.
Oh my gosh.
It is scary. But happy Friday.
Oh my God. Okay, I want happy to... Sorry yeah, to please. Cut in there, but I want to just update you on something. Last week we were talking about The Bachelorette, and we were talking about the food sitch on The Bachelorette, and we were like...
Oh, did you find some stuff out?
No, I mean, I didn't look it up, but I just... It's really... Okay. This really isn't that exciting. But in one of the episodes from this week, they showed a scene of the men...
Yeah.
Eating like breakfast or lunch or something all at a table together. And I was like, they rarely show them like eating meals. You know what I mean? They didn't actually, because you know how it's like a famous thing on The Bachelor and Bachelorette that they no one ever eats a meal on camera, like when they're on the dates. Like they don't actually eat
didn't
the
know
food.
That. Is it because they're like just for optics, it's like less messy and stuff?
Yeah. And like just like basically all they ever air is like their conversation. And like they go sit down at the date and it's like this really romantic table.
So that's
and
like
room.
An inside joke that no one actually
yeah,
eats.
Yeah. Like
on
that
the
you
date.
Don't actually eat the food.
That's funny.
But anyways, when you're not on the date, I mean, I think you eat the like you sit down with the other contestants or whatever. You
right.
know, and eat. And so that's what they showed. They didn't actually show anyone like actually consuming food, but they had like plates in front of them and like it was them sitting down. And I was like, oh, so I guess they do eat together when they're on these resorts.
Like catered buffet, maybe.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. It was probably like they probably get food like brought to them to like a specific room.
I know this sounds ridiculous, but I'm serious when I say like this is interesting to me.
Oh my God, me too.
And if we could just talk about how food runs on reality television shows. Like, I don't know. You don't see, like, how everybody eats throughout the day. Also, I haven't watched Survivor in a very long time. But
me neither.
Aside from, like, I don't know, bugs, how do they
yeah,
how
what
do they
make
eat?
Like, on Survivor? I can't even remember. Rice. They eat a lot of, like, rice. Like they
Are
like,
they
boil.
Responsible for making it?
Yes, they have to make their own food like over a fire. They make like I know
you're kidding.
They make like yeah
every meal.
I think yeah, unless you win like a challenge and you get to go like eat burgers like somewhere, you know.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure you have to make your own food, and you win like sometimes you win food like not just like going to get to go eat burgers, but like
oh my God.
You would win like a bag of rice or whatever. Like I think I can't remember. It's been a long
That's
time.
So funny.
But yeah.
An amazing race. Like they're like yes. running all over the place. Like when do they eat? Like does everyone have breaks that we just don't see on TV?
Or like do you have to eat while you're on the go? Like just pick food up and they don't actually show you like grabbing
right.
food.
Or do
while
you like
you're...
opt out of the break because you want to like beat the other team?
Probably.
So, like you skip a meal or something.
Probably. Yeah. Oh my gosh. We need to find this out. This is so interesting.
This is a whole other podcast.
What do they
I really want to do
reality
it.
TV. Yeah. We should literally start a podcast.
I'm not kidding.
And review every reality TV show and what they eat.
I'm not kidding. I'd be also like reality TV shows that are even trashier, like Too Hot to Handle. Like what's going on there? You know what I mean?
Again,
like,
another show where you did not see anything that they ate. Anyway, we should get
into
it.
That's how I feel about reality TV show food.
I'm so intrigued. I'm
interested in it.
Are you out there listening? Are you interested? Let us know.
If you are a producer on reality television, call in.
We'll have you on the pod. We will literally interview
you. Oh, that's true. We actually will.
And you can tell us what they eat on reality television.
Exactly. Until then, Hannah, until then. Speaking of reality, we've danced around this subject before, and we've given it a little bit of time. We've talked about it in a few different ways, but we've never really dug deep. And I wanted to talk today with you and with the listeners about how to talk to somebody who believes in junk science, someone who believes in pseudoscience, or someone who doesn't trust science.
Yes.
It's, I've talked about this before. Like, I've personally had many difficult conversations with people about pseudoscience, especially as of late with the COVID vaccines, etc. And we've previously talked about, we talk about debunking all the time, but we've had conversations, especially like with Dr. Sajjad Faisal, about how, empathy is like a really good way to make sure that conversations go, instead of going sour, at least keep the conversation going, like being empathic with someone and not totally shutting them out. We've had like little trickles in of what it's like to talk to somebody who doesn't believe in science. I don't know. I guess maybe I'll ask you, do you have any thoughts, just off the top of your head, how you feel about this in general, any conversations that you've had, not specifics if you don't want, but I don't know, just any thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, and it's kind of like you already said, the first thing that comes to my mind is really, it was a big learning moment for me when we talked to Dr. Sajjad Faisal about addressing health misinformation with a lot of empathy. And in order to open up a conversation or a dialogue and, keep an interaction going rather than just shutting someone off and saying no, you're wrong, you're an idiot. Because that, no one's going to, they're not going to become any more open-minded from you just telling them you're a freaking idiot. You really do have to approach these things with kindness and empathy and, and really welcome a conversation, even if, some of the stuff the person on the other side is saying is making you go oh my fucking God, you're,
totally.
This is so wrong. And I experience it, and I've gotten a lot better at it. I used to on social media, if someone left me a comment, a nasty comment saying that this and this worked for me, what you're saying isn't true, this product works or whatever, or this diet works, or celery juice does this or whatever, I used to immediately comment back and be okay, bye. You know what I mean? I would just be dismiss them and just be you're wrong, and not be very friendly and not be very nice. And I have since realized that you can still stand your ground and, stick up for the science, but also do it in a little bit of a better way, I guess. So I've started to approach it with a little more kind of friendliness, a little more, conversation rather than just shutting it down. And it seems to be a lot more well received. So that's kind of the first thing that comes to mind.
I'd say props to you for even continuing that conversation with some people. I would assume that a lot of people would just ignore those kinds of would ignore people who would object to whatever message that they're trying to put out.
But
it's, I think it's really great and it's really commendable that you actually don't mind having those conversations. They can be difficult.
And you know what, the reason behind that is, as a I'm not a seasoned or veteran dietitian, I'm still, I don't know, when did I graduate? 2017 from my internship mm-hmm. and like became an actual dietitian, wrote my exam. So it's only been not, it hasn't even been 4 years. And like, I see it as almost a challenge in a way and a, like an opportunity for me to improve my skills in like mm-hmm. communicating and addressing misinformation. So that's the way I like to kind of look at it is like, this is okay. Here's an opportunity to improve how I communicate about this and maybe promote, you know, more evidence-based communication and evidence-based information. And so that's kind of what I'm, I mean, I'm not an expert at it. I'm not good at it, but that's how I've kind of shifted my mindset when dealing with pseudoscience and misinformation is like, okay, here's an opportunity. Let's see what we can do.
Absolutely. I didn't know that's what you were going to say, but that makes perfect sense. Yeah. And yeah, it's one of those things, like it's a skill, like you can't just like flip a switch and become like a really good communicator. Like I feel that all the time with me. And I know that every time like we do an episode or every time I prepare notes, I know that's like another opportunity for me to retranslate something for hopefully what will be a wide general audience. Same. Which, yeah, I'm looking forward to getting better and better at it each time. So that being said, there is a lot out there on being empathic, being empathetic towards people who don't believe in science, who maybe, you know, back up a lot of pseudoscience and junk science. So, of course, like, empathy is a great place to start. Behavior change we know is very difficult. People tend to, they have to make the decision to change their own mind, right? Like it's difficult to convince someone in the moment because oftentimes people will just want to retaliate or be combative. I really wanted to dig into the literature a little bit to find some more actionable things, just for me to be able to go through this process better, but also to share with listeners. Other than, of course, like empathy, like I think that's like the mindset we have to go into it. But then I thought, okay, well, what are the action items I can actually use in order to then continue that conversation, other than just being a good listener, being an active listener? And I'll also add that speaking to somebody who doesn't believe in science can overlap with, but can be a completely different thing than just like just speaking to somebody who's very ignorant and who might be saying rude or harmful or like mean things, right? So being empathic to somebody who is telling you that you're a dirtbag, I don't know, you can do that if you want, but some of these things may not apply. A conversation is different than somebody just bullying.
For sure.
Right?
I agree.
Those are two different things. So unfortunately, I'm not going to share any of those action items right now, but hopefully we're just going to be able to talk about how to deal with people who don't believe in science or who just believe science is fake or a conspiracy. You know, people who think that the COVID vaccine is made by, or the, COVID vaccine is the government's taking advantage of an opportunity to like cull the herd, so to speak, and reduce overpopulation. There's so much to get into there. Okay. So I found a paper from 2017. The author is Michael Gordon. It's titled, "The Problem with Pseudoscience. Pseudoscience is not the antithesis of professional science, but thrives in science's shadow." So that title, I think, is going to be more and more elucidated, the meaning behind it, as we keep talking here. One thing that it really makes a big point of is something that I think people know generally, that there's a lot of gatekeeping in science, right? It can be very cliquish. There's a lot of jargon. You know, sometimes, not always, but sometimes I can be one of those people that scrolls through a scientific paper, and if I see a mathematical formula, my mind immediately goes, oh, well, I don't know. I'm not going to understand this because there's complex math.
Oh, yeah, same.
Or there's some sort of like, it's some sort of complex coding or something. Like, how am I even going to get see the point of what this paper has to say?
Right.
I may as well just not read it.
Yeah.
So I can really relate to that. There's a lot of barriers that are put up between science that happens behind closed doors at universities that gets published in quote unquote white papers and then the communication that's actually being made with the public.
Yeah.
So the goal often is to reduce that jargon and be able to speak more broadly and in a more applicable way. But even that doesn't always translate properly because sometimes it can make overgeneralizations. Like, for example, Wednesday's episode where we talked about how, you know, this website was saying that spinach could lead to weight loss. Huge overgeneralization from the paper that they were actually citing, right? So there's a lot of... So this is what ends up happening. People will, most of the time, according to this paper, and I think I've seen this myself, I guess anecdotally, but I could definitely relate to this when I was reading it in the paper. Oftentimes, people who maybe do believe in conspiracy theories or don't trust science, when they have conversations with someone who's a proponent of science, the person who's a proponent of science, without knowing, is actually maintaining a lot of these so-called barriers to entry to science, which ends up kind of just like pouring oil on the flames of this whole divide between quote-unquote scientists and not scientists. So oftentimes, you know, let's say, imagine this person who doesn't believe in science is speaking to somebody who's a proponent of science. And let's take the COVID vaccine as an example. Someone who doesn't believe in the science might say, oh, well, you know, people are getting sick when they get the vaccine, right? Somebody who's a proponent of science who, you know, is trying their best to have this conversation, but unfortunately, they don't know that they're still gatekeeping the science, is likely to respond like this. They would say, we know there's an immune response when you get a vaccine.
Right. Okay?
So they're just giving a fact. Or someone who doesn't believe in science would say, who doesn't believe in the COVID vaccine, rather, would say, people who got the vaccine still get COVID, so why bother? And somebody who does believe in science, you know, but still, unfortunately, maybe doesn't realize their gatekeeping, would say something like, well, the fact is, you can still contract the virus, but in the end, the numbers show that having the COVID vaccine makes it so that, you know, your symptoms are more mild. Yeah, people might go to the hospital, but it's actually better in the long run.
Right.
Period. No more explanation.
Right.
They're just kind of just giving facts.
Okay.
They're just giving facts. You know, it's not, no matter how much they might even break down those facts and, you know, they start having conversations about, well, actually, when you have the second COVID vaccine, the second dose, you know, your body is mounting a stronger immune response because you already have developed antibodies and now your body's able to respond even stronger to the challenge of the COVID vaccine. So that is a fact and they're just giving that fact and they're hoping that they're giving the other person the blank that's going to then make them believe in the science. When they're not actually having the conversation, they're not leveling the playing field. They're just maintaining this wall of jargon, this wall of, you know, the cliquishness of like, I'm a scientist and I know about science.
Right.
And I'm telling you what the scientists know. So what you're saying is wrong, and I'm going to tell you the right thing.
Mm.
So even though, I mean, you can be empathic all you want that whole time. You can be like, I really hear what you're saying, but you're wrong.
Right. Like,
but so unfortunately, I think that kind of ends up being the general problem with talking to people who believe in pseudoscience or talking to people who don't trust science. So, and hopefully people can relate to that. Hopefully people can see that, you know, what I've just given is an example of something that, you know, they might relate to or something that they've seen before. Someone giving facts, but not really having a fair conversation with the person during a debate, for example.
Right.
So here are some, so there's four things that I took from this paper. They weren't really like listed as, like, it wasn't like a BuzzFeed article, unfortunately, but if I was to create a BuzzFeed article out of it, I would pull these four tips out of it.
Okay.
So one thing is to just like not be hoity-toity. When you're having that, regardless of how empathic you can be, you might still be promoting the idea of this divide. I'm a scientist. You're not a scientist. I know what I'm saying. You have no idea. Yeah. So let me clear this up for you. Even if that's coming from a place of love, that doesn't work. It alienates people. It makes them feel less than. When in fact, like, I don't know, you might have the same qualifications as this person, like, even on paper, like, there's no reason you should be any different. But sometimes when defending something, people can put a wall up.
Yeah.
You know, they maintain this kind of, what is that called? Like, in-group, out-group scenario. Like, you are part of the problem. Let me fix this for you. You mm-hmm. People put themselves on a pedestal as if they're, like, giving information down, like from up on yonder, from up at the top of the hill,
yeah,
on the academic festival, the academic festival, the academic pedestal. Yeah. Here's the information, right? So that's a real big issue. I don't know. Would you agree with that? Like,
oh, absolutely.
That maybe you've seen that before. Like, I've definitely seen that before, and maybe I'm sure I've been
guilty. Been,
have done it before. Yeah.
Been, oh, like, I'm. I've absolutely been guilty of doing that before. Like, I can think of examples where. Even like making a little like supposed to be like funny but like snarky like TikTok video, and you know,
oh,
making
see.
It
yeah.
kind of like, I'm a dietitian, so I know what I'm talking about. Like,
yeah,
you don't. You know what I mean? Like in response to yeah. again, like some misinformation or something like that. Like, and I can definitely see how that, yeah, would make it seem like, oh, I'm up here, you're down here. Like kind of thing, and I guess that's really not
yeah.
Helpful, because like you said, it kind of yeah. it turns people off from like even wanting it. Just doesn't make people feel good, and
it's almost yeah. like talking to the wrong audience.
Yeah,
like, you're not it's almost like people who are maintaining that gatekeeping just want pats on the back from the people who belong to that same right. group that they believe they're a part of.
Right. Interesting.
It's not going to help change anybody's mind,
no,
right?
It's
so
not.
That's number one. Not to be hoity-toity, not to, you know, maintain the gatekeeping, not to make it seem as if, even though you may be presenting facts, giving those facts in a way in which, like, I'm right, you're wrong. Like, what's that Matilda line? Like, you're little, you're small. I'm smart. Anyway, put that in later in post. anyway, okay, so that's number one. So the second one that I thought was interesting from this paper was to be very frank and to admit the complexity of science.
Mm.
One a line from the paper was an example, anyway, of something that somebody would say if they are admitting the complexity of science is, climate is a very complicated phenomenon. And mathematical approximations give us hope of understanding it, and that takes training. So something else that someone might say, and I'm just thinking off the top of my head in relation to, again, our earlier example of the COVID vaccine, and of course you could throw in any sort of nutrition misinformation there, is a new pandemic and which has like thrown the world off its axle, and trying to understand this novel coronavirus in a laboratory environment, you know, it's going to take so many people with so many different experiences, and so many skills to be able to fully understand how the virus operates and how we can tackle it. So it definitely, I agree with you, it definitely is a very complicated thing, and it's going to take a lot of work to get to where we have a cut and dry answer. So yeah. Yes, I agree. This is confusing. I agree with you.
I
you
love know what that. I mean? Oh, I love that. And I actually, it's so neat that you mentioned that, because I've seen some other RDs approach like certain questions like that. Like again, I keep using TikTok as an example, but I feel like it's a place where there's a ton of misinformation, and also where a lot of back and forth happens, like in the comment section of certain videos. Right. And a dietitian colleague of mine, I can't remember what the topic was. I think it was like dairy and whether or not like you should eat dairy. Obviously that's extremely broad, but, she said something like, you know, nutrition research isn't perfect. But like, this is what we have, or like, you know, something like along the lines of like, and we continue to learn more every year. Right. But you know what I mean? Like, as the science develops or as the research develops. And I just really loved the way she approached it, because, yeah, she just admitted like outright, yeah, like nutrition research is not perfect, and it doesn't give us all of the answers like right away. And we don't have necessarily all of the answers for everything. So I thought that was really interesting, and it just reminded me when you said that, because she did a really good job of that. Yeah.
I think there's hopefully no good scientist who would disagree with that line of thinking. Like, science can be very complicated, is often very complicated, and finding answers can be very complex.
Yeah.
It just, in the moments of having conversations with somebody who maybe doesn't trust science, it almost feels like admitting that isn't going to help you get the win.
Yeah.
Like, how am I going to get a point in this? How am I going to convince this person if I'm like almost betraying my side, the side that I'm fighting for?
Yeah.
But what this paper argues it does, and what I can see this, and from the example that you gave, is that it definitely helps. It helps with the empathy, I think. It helps other people see that you're not coming at it from a point of view where you believe you're perfect. You're coming at it from a point of view where you're almost saying, yes, I agree with the complexity. I'm here to just give you as best as I know based on the complex circumstances.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You're kind of like leveling with them, like, you know, you're not exactly like leveling the playing field, but you're kind of like leveling with them and agreeing. Yeah. And saying, you know what? You're right. It's confusing. I was confused too. But here's what we know.
Exactly.
Yeah. I love that.
Yeah, me too. So number three is to be transparent about scientific miscommunication inside of a field. So this is a nutrition podcast, but I keep using COVID vaccines or COVID as an example. So I hope people are okay with that. But it immediately reminded me of at the beginning of the pandemic, when, you know, every news article was, oh, well, COVID is airborne. And then the next one would be, COVID's not airborne. Well, distancing is important, but you don't need to wear a mask. But you do need to wear a mask because it might be airborne, but it's not airborne until the CDC decides that this level of particulate over this distance in these circumstances means that it's airborne, and then requires a mask. There was so much back and forth. And of course, that would make somebody who like watches the 6 o'clock news frustrated, you know, because they're not, you know, the 6 o'clock news isn't necessarily reporting the discussion section of a paper that says, and we still have more experiments to do. Right?
Yeah.
So this is something that obviously we can do within the nutrition field as well. Scientific miscommunication within any scientific field, I think, it's par for the course, because science is all about answering questions finding problems and answering questions. And oftentimes, one study, the whole reason that a study was made sometimes is because it's in retaliation to another finding. Mm. Well, actually, our lab didn't find that. That's a very scientific thing. And that's how we end up to, if there is a universal real truth, that's how we end up inching toward it. So that's, it's really just part of the whole process.
Yeah.
And I think being transparent about that and saying, oh, well, I get it. How frustrating was it? The World Health Organization took forever to decide on this parameter about the pandemic. Or the Center for Disease Control in the U.S., how many times have they, not totally, but weirdly, based on miscommunication, reneged on masks indoors or in public places, things like that. It's frustrating. And that miscommunication within a field, you know, miscommunication or people having a debate within the field is part of that process, yeah. And hopefully will lead us to the correct answer,
yeah,
with time.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So the last one, which I think is maybe probably the most important one, you know, people should be expecting, is demystifying the scientific process, but not just breaking down the science and detailing it in a less jargoned way or a more approachable way. Not just that, but the actual scientific process. So giving a peek behind the curtain of how all of this works. Yes, there's scientific miscommunication. Yes, there is complexity. Yes, there is gatekeeping. Let me show you this world and let me explain to you how this process actually happens. So for example, someone might say, yes, you know, this whole COVID airborne thing is so confusing. You know, scientists have to develop technologies that can even reliably detect, you know, the coronavirus. And then they have to create scientific environments that are going to let them perform these experiments. And they have to be able to do it all safely. And there's a lot of division of labor involved. You know, there's a lot of people with so many different skills that are contributing to this in not just in one lab, but in labs across the world in order to figure all of this out. People who have worked for years to amass experience and practice that would allow them to answer these questions. It is a really involved process, right? So here I'm showing you, like, it's not just the headline in the news article. Someone didn't just, I'll go to the lab and perform an experiment and I'll have the answer, yeah, for you tomorrow, right? It's not that at all. And of course, the same is true for nutrition science. So it takes a lot of time. A lot of different parties are working on these problems at the same time. And especially in a pandemic, speed is of the essence, right? Mm. People are trying to get the information as fast as possible. Part of this helps society at large because then we, for example, deal with the pandemic. But part of it maybe is because somebody wants the glory first of being the first person to find it. Or somebody is being pressured to get the science out as fast as possible because we need to create public health guidelines.
Yeah.
And then that science changes, and then the public health guidelines change. Yeah. So it's a very complicated process, and I think people don't necessarily know that. I would say that this extends far beyond science. I mean, just from working in hospitals, Hannah, how many, I know this is true for me, I'm not sure if it was true for you, but you know, the more experience I have in my PhD and the more experiences I have that are kind of like healthcare adjacent, you know, I was volunteering in the COVID labs and stuff like that. I didn't really know what was involved in being a medical lab technician, for example, you know, dealing with all the samples, processing them, analyzing the data, you know, prepping all of the samples, getting the results out, making sure it's done properly. I didn't really know all of those steps, right? I didn't think about it. To me, it was just somebody gets a COVID test, they give it to the lab and the lab gives us, right, the result. That's true. But there's also literally hundreds of people making that happen. And they all have you know, different sets of skills, different expertise. They're all working together. There's a lot of different steps involved. They have to do everything properly. So I think there's a lot of those jobs. I mean, I'm sure, you know, even at a grocery store, like working in produce at a grocery store, and when all of the shipments come in, making sure all of the produce is whatever, it's like good to go out on the shelves or whatever, and making sure that it's portioned properly, or making sure that things that are set to expire are here, not there. You know what I mean? There's so much expertise and so many skills.
Yeah.
And because we're not let into the world of science very often, the public isn't let into the world of science, that kind of gets left by the wayside.
Yeah.
I don't know. Do you agree with that? I definitely have had conversations with people who work in like in specialized skill areas who say, nobody knows what I do.
Oh, absolutely. Oh my gosh. I can, I don't know if it's the same, but even as a dietitian working in the hospital, like half the time other team members, like, you know, in the interprofessional healthcare team don't even know what other people on the team do. You know what I mean? Like,
that's a good point.
You know, like, or even being a clinical dietitian in a hospital, people in the public do not know what you do. They like think you make the food that goes out on the trays, for the patients, you
right,
know?
Right.
People have no idea. So I think it's very much, along similar lines that people just really don't see what goes on behind the scenes. And you're right. It's important to kind of demystify that and make it a little more clear.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And it's easy to see why, but it really does hurt. It's easy to see why when someone might say, oh, well, those COVID scientists don't know what they're doing.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, okay, but do you know what they're doing?
Like, also, do you even know what a COVID scientist is? Like, do you even know what their actual role is, or what they've studied, or what their expertise is in? Like, COVID scientists.
Why,
you know,
they even got to this level.
Exactly.
So instead of saying, well, actually they do and they're smart people.
Yeah.
Okay, that's true. That might be true, but here is the world they live in.
Yeah.
And so
here's why
so
they are
four
an
things,
expert in this. Yeah.
Exactly. So these four things, you know, don't maintain the gatekeeping, admit the complexity, be transparent about miscommunication, and demystify the process. I think they make the conversation longer. And, you know, oftentimes you're running into your conspiracy theorist, whatever, cousin at the family get together, and you only have 30 minutes with them, and you want to just blurt out like facts at them, right? To just like make sure you say everything that you want to say. So all of these tips make the conversation longer and I think harder, and probably require more practice. I know I need more practice with this, but I don't know. I can see their benefit.
Yeah.
And I'm definitely going to be trying to, especially demystifying the scientific process part. That's something I think about often, but I end up just demystifying the science more.
Right. Yeah.
Well, actually, an antioxidant is, you know, something that attacks a reactive oxygen species. Well, a reactive oxygen species, is a molecule that, you know, sometimes, whatever, gets made because of the Krebs cycle goes wrong. You know what I mean? Like,
yes.
And then the Krebs cycle is, and then you get into that. Sure, that's scientific literacy, which I do believe is very important. But then there's also this, you know, the world of science and getting what that looks like across to somebody that I think is something that I want to practice. And I don't know, listeners, if this you found this interesting or useful, we'd love to hear from you how you go about these conversations. And maybe if anything that you heard on this episode, really rung true to you, what are you going to use moving forward?
Yeah. I would love to hear too. I think that was so interesting. I was just like, I should have been writing those down because I need to practice that. But obviously,
I can send you my notes.
No, it's okay. I'll have to just listen
I'm just kidding. Yeah,
once it gets edited and goes live, because that was really, really helpful. I thought so. Anyways.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I thought this paper was really cool, and obviously everything will be linked if people want to read the paper directly. And as always, yeah, we'd love to hear what you think. Oh, and we have, it's a Friday, so we have time for a question, Hannah,
yeah,
if you don't mind.
No, yeah, I'm going to ask you, actually. I want to go.
Oh, please, ask me. Okay, yeah.
What has been tasty for you lately?
Pancake mix.
Ooh.
Period. That's the whole story. But I want pancakes. I'm walking through the grocery store. I say, I have flour, you know, I have baking powder. Yeah, I do have eggs. I have milk. And then I think, I'm lucky enough. I have $3. I'm going to just buy the pancake
mix. Yeah, you know what? Pancake mix comes in clutch sometimes. Sometimes you just want to add water, yeah, and that's fine.
Totally.
Yeah.
So that's been very tasty for me. It works. That's all I needed to do. I don't need to have like fancy Japanese souffle pancakes every time I make a pancake. I just rather have a quick, ready to go,
yeah,
out of the pantry.
Totally.
Done. Even if I don't have eggs one day, you know,
yeah,
it can, something could always go wrong.
I love
but
it.
But not with pancake mix.
No, never. I love that. I love pancake mix too. So love it.
Thank you so much. Well, Hannah, what's been tasty for you this week?
Okay. So since we've been talking a lot about TikTok,
yes,
as always, I want to tell you a little bit about something that I've been loving that has recently, you know, I've been loving it for a long time, but TikTok just recently made it cool. Apparently,
okay,
ricotta toast is the new avocado toast.
Oh my God.
As per TikTok. However,
okay,
I've been eating ricotta, yeah, toast for years.
She's an original, people.
Yeah. Hello.
Yeah.
So anyways, I have been eating, like I said, ricotta toast. I've with peaches, with other berries,
oh,
and honey.
Yeah.
And then a savory version with like tomatoes and things like that. I've been eating that forever.
Yeah.
But anyways, the TikTok, kind of like the recipe that has gone viral on TikTok, I decided to make it for lunch, mm-hmm, today just to try it. So, mm-hmm, it's toast with a little bit of butter, preferably like a like sourdough toast or like a, you know, like a bakery
of
loaf
course
of bread, not like sliced
of
bread
course
toast. Like
you're wearing a scarf, it's kind of temperate outside.
Yeah.
Your dog's like wearing a bandana.
Exactly, those vibes.
You have a striped shirt on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. A beret. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yes, a slice of toast, buttered toast, your ricotta cheese on top, and then some blistered cherry tomatoes.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Blister them like in a pan with some olive oil. You could roast them in the oven. And then some olive oil, some good olive,
yeah,
oil,
yeah,
on top, and then some fresh basil, chopped up some fresh,
oh,
basil,
yeah,
leaves,
oh,
salt and pepper. Ooh, mwah, delicious.
That sounds amazing.
It was so good. So thank you, TikTok, for reminding me of ricotta toast and introducing me to that ricotta toast recipe. It was fabulous.
Maybe we'll make some next week when we're together.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
I would
love
that.
That.
We should make ricotta. I've never done it before.
I've never done that.
Apparently,
either.
It doesn't take that long.
Okay, we could try.
I want to say to, if you are the person who makes or works at the factory where they make that yellow horse olive oil, it doesn't taste like anything. So I need you to either fix that or, I don't know, contact someone to help you with that. I can't get a flavor out of it. It's light green water. It's not good for cooking. And it's not good for, I mean, there are grades of olive oil, and I'd definitely give you a C-. So I want you to reach out and tell us what's wrong and if you need help, and we will help you. And I want you to make the olive oil better because it is affordable and I would like to buy it.
Mm, good
at
advice.
That price range.
Yeah. I can't say I've ever actually bought that olive oil, so I can't speak to that, but I take your word for it. I won't be
Thank
buying
you.
It.
And if you are from that Yellow Horse Olive Oil family, I have nothing but love for you.
Yeah, totally. Okay, guys. Well, thank you so much for listening. Make sure that you give us a follow and subscribe to the podcast and leave a 5-star rating and a review and subscribe to us on, or follow, what is it? Follow us on Spotify? I can't remember. I can't keep track of all of these things.
Yeah. Just kind of, if you just write No BS Nutrition on a tiny piece of paper, fold it up, put it in a burning candle, watch that smoke go up. That is really good too. That's just as powerful. That's just as powerful as a follow or a subscribe.
Totally.
So I would recommend that.
Yeah. And otherwise, I hope you all have a fantastic weekend, and we'll talk to you next week.
Yeah, bye everyone.
Bye.